minutes of the day. U.S. versus Aguilar, 094157. You may proceed. Ms. Marston?
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Angela Marston, court-appointed counsel on appeal for the defendant appellant, Mr. Christopher Aguilar. This is an appeal from the United States District Court for the Southern District of Indiana. In that court, Mr. Aguilar was indicted for conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute methamphetamine and possessing with the intent to distribute the same. After the district court denied his motion to suppress evidence obtained during a warrantless search of his rental car, Mr. Aguilar pled guilty to the conspiracy charge but retained the right to appeal the denial of his motion to suppress. This case is about holding the government to its burden to justify a warrantless search. It is well settled that the government bears the burden to prove that a search falls within an exception to the warrant requirement. Once Mr. Aguilar challenged the legality of the warrantless search, it was then incumbent on the government to come forth with evidence to prove that it had probable cause. The government did not do this. Instead, the government submitted briefing telling its version of the facts, but did not attach any supporting documents or affidavits. Thus, the district court had no evidence upon which it could find that there was probable cause to search.
Didn't the district judge give an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing?
The district court did not.
I thought there was a hearing sat and the counsel showed up and declined to introduce evidence.
The government's briefing asserts that there was an off-the-record discussion, that Mr. Aguilar's counsel stated that an evidentiary hearing would not be necessary. What is on the record is that it was suggested it was the court's decision that there not be an evidentiary hearing held. In that discussion, I can point you to was in the motion to dismiss hearing transcript at page 5, actually at page 10. On appeal, the government contends that it did not need to introduce evidence because Mr. Aguilar did not raise a material disputed factual issue. Although he did, in fact, raise material factual issues, it was not his burden to do so in order to trigger the government's burden to come forth with evidence of probable cause. Even absent material disputed factual issues, the district court must still have evidence in order to rule on the legality of a warrantless search. In the cases the government cites on this point are not to the contrary. The government cites cases about the standard that a defendant must meet in requesting an evidentiary hearing, but the government cites no case in which a warrantless search was upheld when there was no evidence in the record about the circumstances of the search. I'll just cite one example. In U.S. v. Martin, this court, the facts of this case were the defendant challenged a warrantless search as a result of an unlawful detention, and the defendant attached the officer's reports to the motion to suppress. It was then determined that there was no need for an evidentiary hearing. The court had the evidence before it, and the court upheld the warrantless search on the basis of that evidence.
Well, let me ask you this. The record is pretty clear that there were these recorded phone call conversations, right? And these conversations outlined the planned drug deal, right? And Braden delivered the cash to Aguilar. That's not in dispute.
Well, Mr. Aguilar did, in fact, dispute the contents of these conversations. First of all, I would note that there was the substance of these conversations.
I thought in the original suppression motion, Braden wasn't mentioned, and then when the government asserted in its response that the parties agreed to the facts, Aguilar didn't disagree in his reply.
Well, Aguilar did not file a reply to the original motion to suppress. He had requested an evidentiary hearing. When the parties showed up for an evidentiary hearing,
but when he ultimately filed his reply, he didn't dispute what was said in the tapes or that the money had been provided, right?
He did not dispute that the money had been provided. Again, there wasn't anything in the evidence that the government presented that there was, in fact, money provided. He did question the content of the telephone conversations. He did say that those conversations only discussed travel plans. There was no discussion of him delivering drugs to the informant. Notwithstanding the lack of evidence in this case, the district court held that there was probable cause on two bases. One was the alert of a drug detection dog, and the other was the information provided in connection with this informant. There's no disagreement that the law requires that these two pieces of information must be reliable in order for a probable cause to exist. I'll talk briefly about the alert of the dog.
Let me go back to the conversations, though, and the hearing. At the hearing, as I understand it, counsel for the defendant said, even though there were telephone conversations that were made, I don't believe they would give the police officer who made the initial stop probable cause for speeding. Wasn't that an acknowledgement that the calls occurred, but it just wasn't an insufficient basis for probable cause? Or were they contested in another way? I'm just trying to get your position on the
table. He never disputed that the calls actually took place. He stated that the content of the calls just involved innocent travel plans.
And was that, were those calls introduced, or transcripts of those calls introduced at the hearing to show they were just innocent?
The transcript of the calls were never introduced. The judge
never had.
They were
available to the defendant.
Pardon?
They were available to the defendant.
We can, there's nothing in the record that states that they were available to the defendant.
But we can assume they were.
We can assume they likely were.
Okay.
With respect to the one basis for probable cause, the dog's alert, there was never a finding by the court that that alert was reliable. The court just said in its order that the positive alert provided an independent basis for probable cause. Rulings of this court make clear that there has to be some evidence that a dog's alert is reliable in order for it to form the basis for probable cause. This is something that Mr. Aguilar specifically disputed. At the hearing, his counsel said there was evidence that the dog was indeed not reliable. On page 6 of the motion to dismiss hearing transcript, she said that the dog wasn't trained, that the dog hadn't received a certification in compliance with national rules for canine training. He had performed his duties in a haphazard way, and he'd given numerous false positives. At that hearing, the government didn't dispute or respond to these contentions with evidence or even with argument. He again, in his supplemental briefing on the motion to dismiss, again refuted the evidence as to the dog's reliability or training, stating that none existed. So this was a disputed issue of fact as to the reliability of the dog. It wasn't his burden to show that the dog was not reliable. It was the government's burden to show that it was indeed reliable, which the government didn't do. Since we've already talked about the informant, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Brookman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. I handled this case at the trial level for the government. And I'm asking the court to affirm the district court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress in this case. The district court denied Mr. Aguilar's motion to suppress without an evidentiary hearing because the essential facts for the motion were not in dispute, and furthermore, because the defendant, through counsel at the time of a scheduled hearing, indicated that no hearing was necessary. That's on page 3 in the transcript of the hearing on the motion to suppress. So in response to Judge Tinder's question, there was a hearing set. The defendant had every ability to have a hearing if he felt he needed one. However, counsel indicated they did not need a hearing.
The statement of counsel just subsequent to that where she says it's the court's decision not to hear evidence?
The transcript says Chief Judge Young came out and said, it's my understanding we're just having argument today. There's no witnesses. And defense counsel said, that's correct, Your Honor. The court said, okay. And then defense counsel says that was the court's decision. What she meant was that what defense counsel meant was that the court was okay without having witnesses on the case. She was not indicating that it was the court's decision not to have witnesses. And I know that because I was there and because there was an agreement that the defense counsel told me that she didn't feel any need to have witnesses at the hearing. That's not in the record, so we can't rely on that. But the statement, I suppose, could be read a number of different ways, but I know that it was that what she meant was that it was not she was okay, that the judge she was okay with the judge accepting her indication that there was no need for witnesses.
And I assume those transcripts were turned over of those phone calls.
There were no transcripts completed at this stage in the case, but the tapes were available, yes. So it was full discovery. Defense counsel knew the circumstances of the co-defendant's investigation and that the phone calls were made. The reports had been turned over.
Weren't there some visual observations of transactions as well?
There were, Your Honor. There was a Mr. Braden, the co-defendant in this case, was there was controlled drug purchase, methamphetamine purchase made with him. The police then went in and conducted a search of Mr. Braden's house, found methamphetamine and these Heidecans that it was being transported in. Braden cooperated with the law enforcement, provided a statement that he'd been getting methamphetamine from Aguilar from Texas for approximately 2 years. They then, in the days following that, the DEA made recorded and monitored phone calls with Aguilar arranging for a money delivery to him for future methamphetamine. The DEA surveilled that meeting between Braden and Aguilar in Evansville. Aguilar came to Evansville, accepted, I think it was $4,000 from Braden for methamphetamine. There were then additional monitored and recorded phone calls where Braden sent Aguilar an additional $3,000 in payment for the future methamphetamine, and they discussed Aguilar bringing that methamphetamine back to Evansville. And then, sure enough, a few days after that, Aguilar arrived in town driving a rental car, and the police stopped him on the road. Now, the important thing is that none of that was ever in dispute. The government recited those and proffered those facts in its response to the motion to suppress, and neither in a responsive pleading nor at the hearing, defendant never disputed any of those facts.
And what about the contents of those recorded conversations? Were they ever disputed, or the interpretation of those?
Well, now here's an interesting thing about those. Defense counsel on a subsequent amended motion disputed the content of the conversations and suggested that those conversations were only because Aguilar was coming to visit a dying relative and that the conversations only indicated totally innocent travel plans.
And was that dispute raised through an affidavit from the defendant or the relative or anyone?
No, it was just raised in the pleading itself. However, at the change of plea hearing later on, Aguilar admitted that those conversations were not about a dying relative or innocent travel plans, but they were, in fact, related to him bringing methamphetamine to Evansville for Braden.
Of course, if the defendant had submitted an affidavit, it would make it difficult for him to get acceptance of responsibility later. It might be considered obstruction if it were false.
Well, absolutely. It would be a perjury. I mean, it would be a false statement to the court if it was an affidavit. The statements were misleading to the court, in my opinion. It's one thing to suggest that perhaps the content of the conversations could be interpreted as being innocent. I think it's a completely other thing to assert that the conversations were about an innocent conversation when you then come back to the court under oath later on and tell them that they were not. So I don't think that dispute really was of any substance, the fact that he at one time indicated that they were innocent travel plans.
What about this police dog alert argument she has that the dog was unreliable?
The court
really never made a finding on that, right?
Well, it did. The court found that as an alternative basis for probable cause, the dog sniff. And I would just bring up 2 points about that.
But that was contested.
It was contested. However, in the original motion to suppress, it was not contested.
Right.
In the original pleading to frame the issues, they never brought up that the dog was unreliable.
But it did come up when you had the hearing.
It came up at the hearing. Of course, I was surprised by that because I didn't know that would be an issue. I wasn't prepared to respond to it at that time. I did respond in a supplemental response down the road, and I laid out the dog's certifications and its training and experience. And I honestly don't think those things would be seriously contested either. I mean, look, either the dog had training or it didn't have training. I don't think defense counsel at the trial level was going to dispute that the training occurred or that it had been working as a drug detection dog. But those things were at least contested in a general sense that we maintain that this dog was unreliable, so to speak. So, but even if you throw out the drug dog, the district court judge still found that there was abundant probable cause based on the informant investigation beforehand. So for those reasons, I believe that the court was correct in denying the motion to suppress. I believe that there was not an evidentiary hearing, but that was in part because there were no disputed facts, and in part because the defense counsel indicated that there was no hearing necessary. And so for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm the decision in this matter.
Thank you. I haven't
used all my time, but if there are no other questions, I would just rely on our briefs.
I think they're not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Brookman. Ms. Marston, how much time?
Counsel has just discussed the controlled deliveries and the information obtained in connection with the informant, and it is the case that that was never introduced into the record. There was no evidence of that in the record, and I would note that this isn't a summary judgment motion. This is a motion to suppress evidence obtained during a warrantless search.
The objection that you're making now, was that made at the district court, that the actual evidence wasn't submitted into the record? I guess what I'm getting at is it seemed like at the district court it was a matter of argument that on both motions defense counsel was asserting propositions, not evidentiary disputes. So there might be a forfeiture there.
With respect to information and with respect to the dog's alert, it was suggested that there is no evidence in the record. With respect to the other, he didn't dispute that this information obtained from the informant actually existed, if that answers your question.
It does.
But I would suggest that this isn't a summary judgment motion. It's not incumbent upon a criminal defendant to create a factual dispute in order to trigger the government's burden to produce competent evidence of probable cause. The law places the burden upon the government to justify a warrantless search because warrantless searches under the Fourth Amendment are presumptively unreasonable. In this case, the officers had ample opportunity to get a warrant. They didn't get a warrant, and they haven't produced any evidence that there was probable cause, and thus we would urge this court to reverse the denial of the motion to suppress and dismiss the case below. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Marston. You were appointed as well, right?
Yes.
We thank you for your service to your client and to the court. You wrote a fine brief, as did you, counsel. Very good argument. We'll take the case under